have a couple of bills on for public hearing today. Our orders today is going to be Senate Bill 729 and then Senate Bill 528, and then we'll move into the work sessions. So we will start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 729. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 729 requires a bicycle to be equipped with a brake that enables the operator to stop within 15 feet from a speed of 10 miles per hour on dry, level, clean pavement. It also states that a fixed brake bicycle does not need to be fitted with a separate brake.
Okay. We have four people signed up. We'll start out with Hazel Gross and Mark Ginsburg.
No, I'm bringing up Senator Atkinson.
Where's he?
He's sitting in a T-shirt.
Senator Atkinson's also here, and he may wish to address this person.
Senator Atkinson,
right? Oh, my gosh, there's been a sighting? Senator Atkinson, please, I didn't recognize you in your civvies. Please come up, Senator Atkinson, and whoever you want to bring. You want to come all by yourself?
Yeah, that's fine.
You are kind of a loner, but welcome anyway.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, member of the committee. Thank you for having me. Madam Chair, I spent $20 on this hearing to wear this T-shirt. Actually, I got it last year. But it says, ride a fixed gear, go to jail. And this issue came up, and what this bill does is it seeks to remedy a problem that we kind of found out about the hard way. What the bill actually does is it fixes a little glitch in the law about
a new... No pun intended?
No, there's no glitch. There's no glitches. Not when I'm fixing the bike.
Never mind. I was referring to your use of the word fix. Okay, I'll stop harassing you. Continue.
Are you harassing me?
Am I that hostile?
Tell us who he was.
This is a hostile work environment. I think he did.
This is Senator Jason Atkinson from Southern Oregon. Okay. For the record.
Got it.
What the bill actually does is it fixes a fixed gear law, Madam Fixed Gear Chair. And what the law actually does is it suggests that the old portion of the law said that you had to have a brake on a bicycle, which makes a lot of common sense, but it doesn't make mechanical sense as it relates to a fixed gear bicycle. Let me explain. A fixed gear bicycle stops when you don't pedal it anymore. You cannot coast a fixed gear bicycle. So it's kind of like your very first bicycle that you had when you were a child, one that you couldn't coast per se, but you wound it up and you wound it back down. And these bicycles have become very extremely popular, especially in the messenger community, but also to serious athletes, because what they do by not having brakes is they force you to use your legs as brakes. So essentially you get a workout pedaling uphill, you get a workout pedaling downhill, and some of the best cyclists ride fixed gear bikes both as training opportunities but also for messengers. And so what we had is we had this reaction in Portland where a messenger was riding one of these bicycles, and it came to be enforced that they didn't have a brake on the bicycle. Well, they don't have brakes because the brakes is in your leg. So what we did is we wrote Senate Bill 729 to fix this situation. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of people here are going to speak to it. But the intent of the law is just to clean up that language and say that you can ride a fixed gear and update the legalese of the bill, or excuse me, of the law, to meet the current trends in cycling.
Okay, now it's your understanding that, because I remember this incident since I live in Portland.
You do, Madam Chair?
I do actually live in Portland. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the nerve to drive a fixie, but, you know, my hat's off to you, Senator Atkinson. But it was my, is it correct that when they enforced against, they enforced this requirement, they were actually enforcing the state law and not a city ordinance? Is that your understanding?
That's correct.
There you are. That's correct.
Good. On the record. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky.
I'm here to fix the problem. When do we vote?
Senator Pazansky, we've already run our way through all the puns.
I know that. That's why I was running down here. I was afraid I was going to trip and fall since I didn't have any brakes on my legs. But I was afraid that the good senator was going to give away all of our secrets of how we get our pedometers to actually count going forwards and backwards.
That's true. In fact, As rebellious as it might sound, as a former candidate for governor, I took a fixed gear wherever I went. And I will say that east of the Cascades is significantly more mountainous than there is in the western part of Oregon. And if you've any fixed gear cyclist behind me will know that riding a fixed gear downhill is much worse than riding it uphill. And anyway, but I've lived. I never crash.
Recognize Senator Walker.
Well, I'd like to say something to you real quickly. Talk about going up hills.
Yes.
But now O and C is on the Senate floor being voted on. And we'll have an answer probably in an hour and a half.
Fantastic.
Okay. Nice. I just talked to Wyden's office, and he's on the floor right now testifying or debating. We hope to have an answer by 6 o'clock our time. He'll call us back and tell us what happened.
Fantastic news.
Okay.
Senator Bates has just tested the bounds of the full service Judiciary Committee. But this is an appropriate time to let him act as a messenger, I would say. Okay, any other questions?
Sure, very nice.
I have one that says obey the law, change the law. Well, that's a nice one, too, so I'll talk to your tailor.
Okay. Any other comments?
No, thank you. I do appreciate you taking it. It sounds like there's a whole host of bicycle bills this year or this session, and I realize to some this may seem like a minor thing or rather frivolous, and in actuality it's not. And I think some of the folks will testify that this is actually the fastest growing area of the cycling community, and it also fits parts and parcel to another bill that I'm working on that'll be out tomorrow that enjoys the co-sponsorship of both Senator Prezansky and your fine self, Madam Chair.
We're looking forward to that one as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, now we will move on to Hazel Gross and Mark Ginsburg.
I've been riding fixed gear bikes for the last...
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Hazel Gross, member of Portland United Messenger Association, Ms. Chair. And I've been riding fixed gear bikes for 6 years and know from experience that a separate brake isn't always necessary if you're a skilled rider. It's kind of like learning how to drive a car with a clutch. You know, you don't just run out into the street and try and drive around. You go to a parking lot and learn how to operate it properly. It's true that there's been a lot of an increase in fixed gear riders in the city, and a lot of people are starting to get ticketed that are skilled bicyclists. So I urge you to support this bill because of that. And I wonder if you have any questions for me about it.
Have you had any accidents due to not being able to stop in time?
No.
And that's
never.
How many years? 6 years?
6 years. Yep.
Good for you. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Mark Ginsburg. I'm an attorney up in Portland. My street address is 6934 Southeast Yamhill Street. I am the former vice chair of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance's board of directors. I'm the current City of Portland Bicycle Advisory Committee chairperson. And as Senator Atkinson alluded to, I'm also the trial attorney who's been handling these fixed gear cases. The proposed Senate Bill 729, which I would urge you to support, has two separate parts. The current Oregon ORS on bicycle brakes, the 815-282A, comes from the 1970s federal model language from the Uniform Vehicle Code. The presumption at that point technologically was that a bicycle had a rear coaster brake. So we said, make it skid. That was the test to make sure your bicycle had sufficient brakes. It's 30 years later, bicycle technology has continued to move forward, and so is the Uniform Vehicle Code language. So that now, if any of us have a bicycle that has a front hand brake, you have two options. If you can make it skid, you probably crash. And if you can't make it skid, you're probably in violation of the now outdated law. So the first part of Senate Bill 729 takes the current Uniform Vehicle Code language and just adopts that with no changes. And I would recommend that part. And then the second piece is that very last phrase dealing with fixed gear bicycles. There are two parts I've given you from my written testimony. One is the, you know, comments on my letterhead, and the other is the federal, the 16 CFR 1512, which sort of outlines that these bicycles are legal at the federal level. And the issue in Portland has been the technical definition of equipped and brake. And we've had some trial courts in Portland agree that a fixed-gear bicycle with no handbrake is equipped with a brake. And we've had some trial courts in Portland disagree that these bicycles are not equipped with a brake. Everyone will agree that they can skid. So it's not that portion. It's the whether or not they're equipped with a brake. And if we actually look at the technical definitions of each of those, I believe that currently fixed-gear bicycles are equipped with a brake. But because we have a disagreement at the trial court level, and these are traffic tickets, $97 reduced to $75, appealing to the Oregon Court of Appeals is not a financially realistic option. So the realistic option is the second part of Senate Bill 729 that just says very clearly these bikes are okay. And what it does not say, to be clear, is that anyone can get on this bike and ride it. It still says you must be able to brake, as the Uniform Vehicle Code says. Stop it in 15 feet from 10 miles an hour. What it does say clearly, though, is you do not need to have a separate handbrake to make that occur.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to confirm for the record that requirement that's being enforced in Portland is a state requirement.
It is the perceived violation of ORS 815-282A, which is a state law, and it is being enforced, frankly, by only two traffic division officers. Portland keeps excellent traffic crash data, and there is significantly a sort of vacancy. There are no collisions attributed to bicyclists on fixed gear as the factor causing a bike versus bike, bike versus car, bike versus ped, bicyclist by themselves collision.
Mm-hmm.
We do hear occasional stories of someone who's tried to ride on a bicycle such as this, and as Hazel mentioned, it's sort of like learning how to drive a stick shift. It is a skill group, mm-hmm. and that's why the new proposed law would say to be legal, you need to be able to stop it. You need to be able to know how to operate this piece of machinery. I also, if we're talking about our bicycle fixed-gear pedigree, I'm a multiple state champion on fixed-gear bicycles on the Velodrome. I ride one of those bikes. I own three of them. I've got a bunch of other bikes. That's a, you know, Senator Atkinson and I can talk about our bikes all day. And really what we're looking for are the two separate parts. One is the simple update to bring the law in compliance with what we actually have in terms of bicycle use now, and then the clarification that fixed-gear bicycles are okay. And the goal of that really, as we talk both at the state level about how Oregon is a great destination for bicyclists, is we want to lower the barriers to people who are riding bicycles. And what this would do is accomplish that by saying your bicycle is welcome here. We've seen one other, Washington, D.C. at the city ordinance level has also clarified their law that fixed gears are okay. Frankly, the way they did it was they also had language which looks like our current ORS 815-280, the 1970s federal model language, and they just added one line that said fixed gears are A-OK. Ours is a little bit broader because it updates the entire law appropriately and clarifies that fixed gears are OK.
OK, but this wouldn't preclude, if there was a city that for some reason had a problem, it wouldn't preclude cities from adopting ordinances.
That's correct. There'd be no limitation on a city passing a specific ordinance if they felt there was a concern.
And this is just permissible because some fixies do have an ancillary brake, isn't that
correct?
True?
And certainly just as with bicycle taillights, because this is equipment violations that we're technically talking about,
mm-hmm.
equipment violations like a traffic ticket level. For bicycle lighting, it says this is the minimum. You can always do more. And there's nothing here that would limit you from having a fixed gear with 2, 3, 4 as many additional brakes on top of the fixed gear as you wished.
And since the bicyclist is usually the one to get damaged if there's an accident,
they certainly have a motivation to make sure they can operate the machinery in a safe and legal manner.
Kind of a built-in incentive there.
Yes.
Especially on the busy streets of Portland. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Pisanski.
Yeah, I guess one question is, I'd like to be on your mailing list when you have your garage sale, knowing what Jason has in the garage. Mark, I assume that you'd also have some nice equipment. I do want to clarify one of the statements regarding what cities would be able to do in ordinances. The conversation between yourself and the chair gave me the impression that you're saying that the cities would be able to actually have a stricter standard than what state law would require?
I would defer to you as the legislators to know the machinations of that more than I. But just as, for example, with sidewalks, ORS allows bicyclists to ride on sidewalks. Several cities in Oregon have limited that scope. In Portland, you may not ride your bicycle on the sidewalks in downtown in a very limited geographic area. Could it be possible for a city via city code to limit it? I will defer to you, but off the top of my head, my belief would be maybe.
Yeah, I don't see preemption here, Senator Pazansky.
I do. I think if you have a state law that says this is what's required, I don't know if I would want to be in a situation that we then have individual cities adopting different standards, because then we lose the uniformity. And I have always interpreted that the state vehicle code is applicable across the state, and that a city, and I would use the Dollarhide case, as to whether or not you can have a different standard that's going to be more restrictive. Now, I understand the issues regarding in the metro areas. Eugene has the same as to not riding a bicycle on the sidewalks within a 6x6 square block area. But it would seem to me that I would like some clarification as to whether we could have multiple standards, and depending on what city you're in, as to what equipment's going to be required or not, because that to me would take away from being a bike-friendly state. If you have someone that was traveling, flying into Portland and then going over to, let's say, Sun River, and they're going to be in Bend, they're going to be in Sisters, and who knows where else, if they're going to have different standards.
Okay, that's a question that does need to be answered.
To the extent that, you know, my short answer is I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly be my belief that the state law is the state law, and whatever powers the cities have in preemption issues that exist are there for you to address.
Go ahead.
I believe the way it is if the state is silent on an area, then the cities are more open or free to actually enact.
Fill in the empty space.
But if we've taken a position in saying this is permissible as to the type of equipment that's required, then I think the state has in fact spoken, unless we actually said that there could be stricter standards on a city.
A reservation phrase.
Yeah.
Well, this says, we will look into this, because this says that a fixed gear bicycle is not required to be equipped with a separate brake, and that means it's not required under state law to be.
Correct.
I'm not sure. I think you could argue this one both ways, and I think safety is always paramount. But
I also don't foresee that being an issue. I do not see any cities taking this up to be more restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
The place where that particular issue became an issue is simply two very well-respected police officers with whom I get along fine, despite the fact that we've tried perhaps 20 of these cases together, with mixed results at the trial court level. Additionally, the Oregon trial lawyers, the timing didn't work. Their legislative committee meets tonight. I'm also a member of the Oregon trial lawyers. My understanding at this point is they have no objection, but because their committee has not met yet, they will be coming out as early as tonight or possibly tomorrow with a position which I anticipate will be in support of, and they've asked me to express that to you as well, and they'll bring forward information if this committee wishes it.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments, questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. My contact information is on my written stuff. If I can be at any help at all, please do not hesitate.
Great. Well, Ken, thank you for your service on the advisory committee.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to serve.
Okay, Jonathan Mouse and Scott Bricker. Welcome.
Hi, members of the committee. Thank you, Senator Burnick. Thank you. My name is Jonathan Maas. I'm the editor of BikePortland.org, which is a daily online news magazine that covers bicycling in Portland and Oregon. And I'm also formerly a marketing consultant in the bike industry for 5 years previous to doing that. I'll have to.
The recent winner of the Bud Clark Award, I believe.
No, not quite the Bud Clark Award, just an Alice Award.
I won one too, so congratulations.
Hello. I'll edit my testimony a little bit because several of the issues I wanted to bring up have already been raised. I would like to just back up for a quick moment and say that since July, which was the initial court case that really led us to this point, I've written 15 articles on this issue on my site and received over 900 comments in response to all those articles. This is not this may seem like a, like an obscure issue for competitive cyclists or for messengers, but I want to let you know that it is a larger issue. It is important to more Oregonians and even people around the world than you might think. And I think a big reason for that goes beyond just fixed gear bicycles, and the brake requirement is that we have a situation where there's a lot of confusion because we've had some differing opinions at the traffic court level, and I think the reality is we're dealing with a law that is just outdated and needs to be updated. So I think we also have a situation where there are, like Mark has referred to before, there are police officers on the ground doing any number of different things, requiring bicyclists to do things that aren't even really stipulated in the law, like put a front brake on, which who knows where that came from. So this confusion is just not a good thing. We need to put an end to it. And the last thing I'll say is, as someone with experience in the bike industry, and I do still keep in touch with that industry, is fixed gear bicycles are a rapidly increasing part of the market, and it's not just bicycle messengers and competitive athletes. These things are being ridden by a diverse group of cyclists, and they're going to be out on the streets. And bicycles with fixed gears have been ridden for over 100 years in this country, and it's just, I think it's crazy to even have the specter of that they're illegal even floating around. So I just urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your time and listening.
Thank you. And it's your understanding that the folks who are responding to your website have no problem with the requirement that the bike actually be able to stop within 15 feet at a speed of 10 miles an hour, that requirement is not a problem for these bikes?
I would imagine so, yeah, not a problem. And again, it's really important, like what Hazel said, this is not something that you're just going to get on and go ride around on willy-nilly. It is a little different than some other bicycles or if you're used to handbrakes. There is a learning curve there. And just for your own information, I don't necessarily ride one of these bikes. I've practiced on one in a parking lot, but that's not where my interest is. My interest is in just trying to clear up what I've been seeing as a ton of confusion being at the center of this storm. With the reporting I've done.
Thank you, and thank you for your work on bike.org. Bikeportland.org, excuse me. Questions from the committee? Okay, Scott.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Bricker, and I'm the policy director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Thanks for having me and having this bill. The BTA supports this bill, and I just wanted to basically add a little bit onto what folks have said. I think people have clarified it here really well. I do believe that this bill does two separate things, as Mark had outlined. The first thing really is dealing with the brake and the skid issue, fixie or no fixie aside. Technology has changed. Using the measure of a skid, which is actually something which is a low performance issue, is not in our mind, is not a good way to measure the performance of a way to stop a vehicle. In fact, automobiles have anti-lock brakes and anti-skid wheels. Not skidding is the ideal scenario here. So having just a performance measurement for a bicycle makes the most sense for us, and we are fine. We think this standard measurement is good. And in fact, I have a bicycle, my favorite bicycle, that only has a front brake. And there is no way to skid that front brake. And I've put a little citation here from a website called howthingswork.virginia.edu that talks about how front brakes are actually more effective than rear brakes. So again, I think the first part of this bill is just a real basic but necessary cleanup to make things work. As it goes for the fixie issue, we do think that if you can stop your bicycle within the performance measure required, that should be legal. We do think that there might be a way to even make it simpler and just remove some of the wording on brakes and just have performance measurement and not even talk about brakes. But it's not necessary. If the committee is interested in hearing more about that, I'd be happy to talk about that. We do support this bill. We hope that you'll move it out. Thank you.
Boy, I can't imagine how you could do just a front brake and not take a header going downhill.
Well, I'm a certified League of American Bicyclists cycling instructor, and one of the things they do in that training program is teach you how to do a quick stop. And part of that is when you do a quick stop, you press three times as hard on the front brake as you do in the rear brake, and you shift your weight over the rear wheel. So through the course of that, the actual goal is to be able to stop without any use of the rear brake, and that would stop you effectively as fast as you can, because the front wheel has a downward force when you brake it, and the rear wheel has a backward, more of a drag force. So I'm able to stop my bicycle effectively by shifting my weight over my rear wheel and slam down that, and I've never gone over the handlebars. So try it out on your bike.
I'll have to invite you to Southwest Chesapeake Avenue. See if you can pull it off there.
Madam Chair, my question. Daughter is a pilot, and when they train you, they cut the engine while you're in the air so that you know what to do in emergency. Sounds a little bit like your bike experience.
A little bit, yeah. Having some kind of way to stop, I think, is pretty essential. But you also do learn how to fall. Kind of like skiers learn how to fall. Bicyclists, there's a class on how to fall in case something does go wrong.
That's good. That's good for when you first use toe clips. Any questions from the committee?
Is it Alice B?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have one comment in relation to what Mr. Brady just said. Thank you. This is Mark Ginsburg again. If you actually
have a seat, Mr. Ginsburg, so we can hear you.
I apologize. The trial lawyer tendency to stand when speaking to folks. In terms of brakes, one of the things we can also look at for guidance is ORS about motorcycles. Motorcycles in Oregon are only required to have one brake, and that brake is actually required to be either, this is off the top of my head, I believe it's muscular, spring, or energy powered. So a motorcycle in Oregon with a front caliper or disc brake would be perfectly legal, akin to what Mr. Bricker has described on his bicycle as well. And that's current ORS that is not a problem at all. We've never seen any issues with that in terms of the requirements of the law here in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 729. And I don't know. Are you ready to work this? Any questions on that?
Fine.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 729. Senator Walker.
Well, I just want to know if this is the last bicycle bill of the
session. No, this is only the beginning, Senator Walker.
We seem to have had a lot of them this session. Yeah. Not that I'm opposed, mind you, but
we are the bicycle committee.
We are.
Senator Beyer, I don't know how you feel about this bill. Would you feel comfortable making a motion for your caucus member?
Do you want to know the truth?
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I'll move Senate Bill 729 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 729 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, I just have to say I appreciate the written testimony of Mr. Ginsburg in addition to his oral argument, that even for legislators who do not ride bicycles, this portion of Senate Bill 729 should be viewed as simple housekeeping. I am one of those legislators who does not ride a bicycle, though I know how.
That's good, Senator Walker.
I prefer to sit on the back of my husband's motorcycle.
We won't put you on a fixie anytime soon,
all
Senator
right.
Walker.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
The good senator whose office is next to mine is not talking about this bill yet, so he'll have to come talk to me to get my affirmative vote.
Do you want to be registered as a no in committee, Senator
Beyer?
Put
him on notice.
Okay. Would you take the roll, please?
Senator
Przanski? Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Burke?
Aye. Okay, it's adopted. I will carry this bill.
Who's carrying
it? Oh, actually, we'll let Senator Adams
I think we should let the good sponsors, because he needs to actually win over one of our colleagues.
Yeah, he may actually get some votes on the other side of the aisle if he carries this. So, okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 528. New counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 528 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The bill requires that the superintendent of the state hospital to only deliver to a jail a person sent to the state hospital for evaluation concerning the person's ability to aid and assist in his or her own criminal defense if the superintendent has sent the trial court a written evaluation concerning the person's ability to aid and assist in his or her own defense takes effect upon passage.
Okay, Alex Bassos and Amy Alkanich.
Madam Chair, we're looking forward to ask Council a question.
Sure.
I see we have a fiscal on the bill, and I'm surprised because I thought this bill was actually going to save us money.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, this is a fiscal that we received. I understand LFO got it from the state hospital. This is a puzzling area to me. And I think you may hear some of this as we get into it from the witnesses, because the statute says that when the court finds someone unable to aid and assist, they turn that person over to the custody of the superintendent of the state hospital. I cannot find anything in statute that says that the superintendent of the state hospital can return that person to the jail. In fact, I understand there was a court case on the Ninth Circuit. On the other end, as far as after the court makes that determination, the person would sit in a jail for a period of time where the federal judge said under Oregon statute the person is in the custody of the superintendent, the state hospital, not the jail. So as I said, I'm puzzled.
Thank you.
Okay, maybe we'll get some insight on this in a minute, Senator Beyer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Amy Alkanich on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, who is sponsoring this bill. I'll only speak briefly, and I'm going to let Alex Bassos, who is here on our behalf, speak. He's been practicing law for 7 years in Oregon. He's the head of the Special Courts Unit at the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. He's on the board, the Oregon Advocacy Center, and is currently editing a book on the issue of mental illness and criminal defense, among other topics. He is our resident expert on this issue, so I'm going to allow him to speak. I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have after he's done talking.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Bassos.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Alex Bassos. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 528 on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm honored to be here today to talk to you about an important clarification of the fitness to proceed law for my most fragile of clients, those criminal defendants who are unable to rationally understand their circumstances or assist in their defense in even the most basic way. For the majority of these defendants, there is a hearing at the county court, at the circuit court, and a statutorily mandated report from a psychiatrist or psychologist, after which folks are committed to the custody of the Oregon State Hospital to be treated until fit. The commitment to the custody of the state hospital ends only when the committing court, the circuit court, has made a decision that the person either is now able and fit to proceed, or is not going to be fit to proceed in the foreseeable future, or has served their maximum time, that is, the lesser of 3 years or the maximum sentence that they could serve. The linchpin here is that the court, the circuit court, has to make a decision in order for that commitment to the custody of the Oregon State Hospital to end, in order for criminal proceedings to be resumed. Criminal proceedings are suspended for the period of time that the person has been committed to the custody of the state hospital. The way the statutory framework is supposed to work, and supposedly does work, is that when the state hospital believes that a person is now fit to proceed, they've been treated for a while, they've gotten on medications, they've stabilized, the state hospital notifies the circuit court that they believe that the person is now fit to proceed. The circuit court, the committing court, then has a hearing at which they make that linchpin decision. The problem arises and has arisen for us thousands of times over the years because the state hospital makes a decision and writes it in the chart that they believe the person is now fit to proceed, but then it takes them 2 weeks, sometimes three, for them to complete a report and get it to the court. Since they've made a decision, they feel that they can discharge the person. They call the county sheriff, who comes and picks the person up. The person then sits for 2 weeks, sometimes three, in the county jail. before we're able to have a hearing. No judge that I'm aware of in the state is having a hearing to decide whether a person is currently fit to proceed without one of these reports from the state hospital. And those reports, which, by the way, that is part of the amendment to the statute that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is proposing, is that a report be written, but the evaluators at the state hospital are writing that report on every single case anyway, so that isn't a change in policy, that's just a change in statutory requirement. So it's that 2-week to 3-week gap that is really damaging, and I'll talk in just a second about why it's so damaging. It goes to two things, decompensation and discharge planning, both of which are significantly affected. But let me just say that the statute is really clear that, first of all, the person is committed to the custody of the state hospital until the court makes a decision. But there's an Oregon administrative rule on point that also makes it clear. That's OAR 309-031-0010 that says that that the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division cannot release or discharge the person when the person is at the hospital being treated until fit, until they have specific approval of the appropriate legal authority, the appropriate legal authority in this case being the circuit court who committed the person, the committing court. So the reason that we're bringing this bill, that the OCDLA is proposing this bill, is that folks are getting sent back and they have to wait in jail for 2-3 weeks before they have their hearing. They're in this legal limbo. It is not uncommon, though it doesn't happen in every case, that a person decompensates over those 2 weeks such that by the time they get to the hearing, even if they were fit to proceed when they were first sent to the jail, they are no longer fit to proceed. Now, it is in the nature of mental illness and the clients and the sort of clients that are sent down there and the sort of mental illness is that almost everyone decompensates to some extent when they're sent back to the jail. It's just a real and different environment where the resources just aren't there to treat them as they are at the state hospital. So everybody decompensates to some extent when they're sent back. The problem is that some folks decompensate so much that they have to go back to the state hospital, and sometimes a churning occurs solely because of this gap between the time that the person is sent back and the time that the report is written. Now, there are often cases where we have everything set up. For example, we've already negotiated, for example, an insanity defense plea with the district attorney, and what we need is for the person to be lucid enough to talk to them about the case and what kind of decision they want to make. So if we're able to have a hearing right away after the person comes back, we can avoid that churning in quite a few of these cases, and ultimately what I'm saying is save money. The other way that this bill is really helpful and would also save money is discharge planning. Right now, we don't know when the hospital is going to make their decision, and as soon as they make their decision, they immediately send the person back to the jail and basically close their files. If they were down there for that 2 weeks while the report was being written, we would be able to work with the social workers down there, work with the staff, and set up a plan so that the person would not hit the streets right away and risk immediately being destabilized once they were released. We can avoid the other churning, which is much more common, which is that the person gets released because they're lucid and they just want out of jail, but there's no plan yet, so they're back in within weeks, and we see that all the time, the same set of folks going in and out of jail. These two, avoiding that rapid decompensation for some folks and the churning between the jail and the state hospital and that churning between the jail and the community are the two major policy reasons why this is such a great bill and what we'd like to avoid. But frankly, it's completely consistent with the requirements of the statute that the person remain in, and the OAR, that the person remain in the custody of the state hospital while they're writing their report. So we believe this is simply a clarification of the statute, not an amendment or a change.
So there's nothing in this bill that would, and that the state hospital could write the report like that very same day. I mean, they don't have to take the full 2 weeks that they take now. Is that correct?
I was just down at over at the state hospital this morning for an evaluation and talking to some folks again. That 2 weeks occurs because they're required to dictate their report, so it goes to folks who transcribe the dictation, goes back to the evaluator for review, and then works its way through the bureaucracy of the state hospital, as I understand it. And that process usually takes about 2 weeks from the time of the decision. In order to change that, they would need to change their internal policy, I guess. But
That's where the fiscal comes. The Legislative Department of Human Services is adding 12 days onto everyone they ever had or ever will have there, which seems like kind of a crazy outcome for this. I agree with Senator Beyer. This should be a cost-saving measure, not a costly measure.
And we would agree, Chair Burdick.
The other question I had is, when under current practice now, when they send the people to a jail, jails are many times overcrowded and they matrix people out. Do these people sometimes end up out on the street while this is being decided, or have they been pretty successful at keeping them inside the jail?
At least in Multnomah County, Chair Burdick, where I'm most familiar, I haven't seen a lot of matrixes from folks coming back from the state hospital. I haven't seen that happen a lot. So I guess that isn't as big a worry. That certainly is possible, depending on the overcrowding and the level of the case. I would add one more thing, which is that I was just speaking to the evaluator this morning, and Dr. Reichlin, the head of the evaluators, the other day, who informs me that some county sheriffs won't take folks if the report hasn't been written. So apparently it is the presumption of the state hospital to attempt to send the person back, but they must recognize on some level that they're getting away with something because they will keep the folks if the sheriffs say, hey, keep them.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the committee? Thank you very much. Do you have anything else to add, Amy?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, only that the National Alliance on Mental Illness has asked that we inform the committee that they are in support of this bill.
Thank you, and we have written testimony from them up here. Thank you. Okay, Bob Junedeff and Marvin Fickle. Welcome, Bob.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I'm from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and I'm here to speak in favor of this bill, but also to alert the committee as to what I think are some problems in the existing statute and some of the problems that they cause. The Oregon Advocacy Center is very involved in this particular area of the world, in that we advocate on behalf of folks in the state hospital and follow them through in all the processes that bring them in and take them out of the state hospital. We visit on a regular basis people in the hospital and also in jails when we receive complaints of abuse or neglect or rights violations of those individuals in jail. And what we see in terms of our clients are situations in which people do return to jail after being held for aid and assist. And depending on the county, there are circumstances in which, because a person cannot be forcibly medicated in a jail setting, that they can decompensate in the jails. But there are other instances in which people are returned. And when there is a return from the hospital to the jail, that individual now moves away from treatment from the professionals in the hospital setting. They're in the jail, and we have counties in which the medical personnel in the jail don't provide treatment. for those individuals or have policies that restrict the types of medications they give or any medications at all. So there is a problem in terms of an effective transition of people from the hospital back into the jail setting. And so having that work efficiently works well for everybody. And I think we should want that to happen for a lot of different reasons. The second thing is that the Advocacy Center did file a lawsuit a number of years ago that went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals called Oregon Advocacy Center versus Mink. The Ninth Circuit ruled that really interpreted the state statute on its face to say that when a person is committed because they're unable to aid and assist, that they are committed to the hospital and not to the local jail. The state had defended its practice in leaving people in jail for weeks and months awaiting transfer to the hospital on the theory that the statute in fact committed to the local jail system. Court said no and ordered that the hospital take individuals who have been ordered by the judge to the hospital, take them within 7 days of that order. And it would seem that on the face of the statute that as long as that judge's order of commitment to the hospital exists, that the hospital is the proper entity to have custody of that individual until they are ordered to be returned to the court for hearing on their aid and assist matter. Problem, of course, is that we had testimony earlier about crowding in jails. The fact is that our state hospital, Oregon State Hospital, has been at over its funded census for as long as I can remember. Our organization sued the hospital because of overcrowding a year ago, and right now there's even more individuals in that hospital than there were when we filed the lawsuit. As I understand it, there are now, and the doctor may be able to correct me, 12 vacancies for physicians at the hospital. The agreement that we reached with the state in order to resolve the overcrowding called for the state to create a number of new community beds in which people could be transferred. The state has achieved under half of its promised number of beds to create in the community. So all this adds up to the fact that this is a overcrowded system in general, and wherever you choose to squeeze, there's going to be a burden placed on some other part of the system, and I think the committee should be alerted to that fact. The last thing I wanted to say is that the statute as written, and I try to address this in my written testimony, but the statute as written create some ambiguity in terms of how quickly things are supposed to happen and who's supposed to do what. I think that this bill would help in terms of requiring the report to go along with the patient, but the statute could clearly say unambiguously when the individual is supposed to be transferred and when they're supposed to be transferred back and under what conditions, and it just doesn't do that right now. In fact, I think it's ORS 161-370 sub 7 can be read to say that 30 days that notice must be given to the court 30 days before transfer. And I don't think that's what anybody has intended, but that appears to be what it says. So my message is that I don't think if the committee will not be necessarily solving the larger problem just by passing this bill. I think it would help to pass the bill. But this whole section statute could use some reworking.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Dr. Fickle.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marvin Fickle. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services to speak against Senate Bill 528 for reasons which we'll enumerate. Currently, a patient who is sent to Oregon State Hospital due to their inability to aid and assist is returned to jail when the patient has been deemed fit to proceed, and a full report is sent approximately 12 days later. Senate Bill 528 would require the report be sent to the court prior to the patient returning to the jail. This would cause patients to wait in the state hospital about 12 days longer on average and would increase the overall census by a similar amount. Oregon State Hospital has closely monitored the timeliness of aid and assist reports for persons returned to jail. As stated above, the last year reports were sent to the court in approximately 12 days. The median was 12 days. All persons returning to jail have documentation from a nurse and a doctor that describes the treatment provided in the hospital and treatment recommendations. According to our records, there has been only one incident within the last year that the tardiness of a report has caused a minor delay in a hearing. Oregon State Hospital was, as you heard from Mr. Junedef, recently sued over the overcrowding on our forensic wards, and the settlement which was reached requires the department to do everything possible to reduce the census at the hospital. The hospital additionally is being investigated by the United States Department of Justice, as I'm sure you're aware, for potential violations of rights afforded to persons in institutions, which includes issues related to overcrowding. The department is attempting to actively address these issues, and this bill would compound the difficulties in effecting the needed changes. Oregon State Hospital is currently 27 patients above its budgeted capacity. The increased census resulting from this bill would need to be addressed with the development of community facilities, additional community facilities. By moving patients from the state hospital into community programs, state hospital beds would become available to handle the increased demand. The development and operating cost for 10 secure residential beds for 18 months is estimated to cost $2.8 million. These costs are not addressed in the governor's recommended budget. For these reasons, the department opposes Senate Bill 528 due to the further strain this bill would cause to the hospital census and on additional community resources. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in this matter. I'm available for any questions should you have any.
Hey, Dr. Fickle, you said that the median was 12 days. That means that there is a lowest number and a highest number. What was the range that produced this median? What was the longest period of time it took to get a report out?
The longest report time was 21 days, which was the reference that I made. That person no longer works at the hospital.
And what was the shortest time?
I believe a fair number of reports go out within 1 to 2 days, depending, again, the time of the week that the transcription is done or is dictated and transcription is completed.
Okay, so what would prevent all the reports from getting out within 1 to 2 days?
Up until very recently, our transcription services were woefully inadequate, and they continue to be for all of the services that we provide. We have made the transcription of these particular reports a high priority and have further reduced the time in which we should see within in looking at the next year's reports. We cannot guarantee that our transcription services will be able to function at the level they are now due to many of the same factors that make that cause our inability to hire a variety of different professionals.
Okay, so if you is there a way that you could inform the court with some kind of top-line report and provide the rest of the report when the hearing actually takes place? Because I presume there is some delay in the court scheduling the hearing.
It is my understanding, Chair Burdick, that the reports are normally received well in advance of any hearings, often weeks before those hearings, as you heard testimony previously. We could, at the time of discharge, certainly provide a up and down comment on the discharge forms. That's not something that we would be opposed to doing. But to provide a a completed report does take additional time for the person who's doing the evaluation and to dictate them.
So right now, between the time when the court gets the report and the hearing actually takes place, the person is in the jail in that whole time?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Well, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I think it's probably helpful for you to understand that there are a variety of different kinds of situations which we would make alternate decisions. There are some people, for instance, who clearly would benefit by a sustained hospitalization, and we will keep them in the hospital until the day of the hearing, if that is appropriate. However, you can imagine that if those numbers of cases were increased substantially, it would greatly overtax our currently rather sparse resources and budget.
Well, because it seems to me from your description, the problem is not the, you know, 1 to 12 days or 1 to 21 days between the decision and the report being ready, but it's also a period of weeks or months until the court has its hearing. Isn't that the bigger problem?
Madam Chair, I couldn't give you an opinion as to whether it's a greater problem or not. I think that it varies widely from county to county, depending upon how they choose to operate, and probably from judge to judge.
Mr. Bassos, why don't you come up and address that, because that wasn't an element of your initial testimony.
Thank you, Judge. Wow.
I've been waiting for someone to do that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. In the county, we can schedule a hearing as soon as the person gets there. We can get a hearing on for the next day or two. The problem is that we need the report to continue. I believe what Dr. Fickle is referring to is that under the statutory scheme, a 60-day evaluation must be performed for a 90-day hearing. And generally, the reports are getting to the court prior to the 90-day hearing. But
where's the person all this time? That's what I'm unclear on.
During the period of time after the state hospital has made a decision, that is, mm-hmm. the decision has been written in the chart, and the time that the report is completed, the person is sitting in the county jail.
And then between that time and when the hearing actually takes place, where is the person?
Also in the county jail, but we can get a hearing within a day or two, no matter when we get the report. Whether it's 2 weeks before the 90 days or
what 90 days are you referring to?
They're required to have a hearing at the court at the 90-day period, a 60-day evaluation for a 90-day hearing. And it's usually just scheduled that way.
Counsel.
So you're talking about 90 days after they're sent by the judge to the state hospital.
That's correct. And then there's supposed to be a report every 180 days after that. So we schedule hearings. We have to have some way to keep track of the case, and so we'll put it on the docket for a particular day. But that can be rearranged very easily, no matter what the county, even in the crowded dockets of Multnomah County. It has to do much more with when we're ready to proceed to a hearing, not when the current hearing is set. That, in some ways, that particular date is almost irrelevant because we can move it around so easily.
Chair Burdick, I might just comment that the way the system is set up is that when a person is originally sent to the hospital has 60 days in which to conduct an initial evaluation and to submit a report to the court. And at that point, they can find either the person is able to aid and assist and ready to return to face their charges, will never regain capacity, such as a person with a very low IQ or a very serious brain injury of that sort, or that they're not presently able to aid and assist, but the hospital believes that they might be able to regain capacity if they receive further treatment. So that information goes back to the court, and the court can act accordingly upon that information. But then the person, if the person falls within the category of the hospital believing that they might be able to regain capacity, then the person remains in the hospital until the hospital then reports that the person finally has regained capacity, or 3 years pass. There's a 3-year ceiling on the entire period of time a person can be held for this purpose. And so many of the situations occur when the person finally regains capacity and they are now presumably ready to go back to hearing before a judge to make that final determination, because the court gets to make that decision. The hospital doesn't ultimately. And it's then that the person may be transferred and then wait for some time before the hearing is set. And the person gets to have the official decision made whether they can face their charges or not.
Okay, so, I mean, why couldn't you just have one sentence, this person is, you know, from the hospital, maybe to be followed up later with a report?
Because it is the court's decision to make whether the person is fit to proceed. Mm-hmm. And we need the report from the state hospital to find out why the hospital believes that the person's situation has changed. That's it.
Standard by.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Fickle, I guess I'm just quite confused by the statutory construction here, or your interpretation of it, I guess, that you would be able to send these people from the hospital back to a county jail when, and as I'm reading this, the court in sub 2, section 1, the court sends them to you and they're being in the custody, your custody, and I'm looking online, I think it's line 18 and 19. No, I suppose that the court may release the defendant on the terms of down the line, about line 21, 22, it says that you guys have to keep them, the way I read that. Then if you go back, and then if you go on to 3A under current law, it's 4A, line 15 on the second page of the bill, it says the director, the superintendent or director shall immediately notify the committing court if the defendant at any time gains or regains capacity to stand trial or will never have the capacity to stand trial again. And then you go down to about to line 29 through 33 again, it says that the superintendent or director determines that there is a substantial probability that in the foreseeable future the defendant will gain or regain capacity to stand trial unless the court otherwise ordered the defendant shall remain in the superintendent's or director's custody where the defendant shall receive treatment designed for the purpose of enabling the defendant to gain or regain capacity. I don't understand how you have the authority to send this person back to a county jail under the statute.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I believe that the questions that you're raising here are very substantial ones. I am aware that Mr. Taylor has raised similar ones with the AG's office, and they are currently discussing that issue. I have followed the procedure, which has been the standard in this state for well over 20 years, of which I am aware, and I do believe there is some issues there which were raised by several of our people today. In terms of the specifics that you ask about, for instance, the superintendent determines that there is a substantial probability that in the foreseeable future, that portion of the law is referenced to those people who, with treatment, may be able to continue to be able to aid and or will be able to aid and assist at some point in the foreseeable future. Obviously, we do keep those people because they're undergoing further treatment. To the extent that there has been any concern over this portion of that process, I was never made aware of any difficulties by any courts in this state. And in fact, that the jails have been the one who, in essence, organizes the transfer to the back to the jails, back to the county, has been the practice probably since the 1950s.
Counsel?
When I first read the bill, I was puzzled myself, and I emailed Bob Nickel. I did not email the Department of Justice concerning my concerns. But I do have a question for Dr. Fickle. Mr. Bacco said earlier that some jails have refused
to accept, to pick up people who are at the state hospital, who are down there to be for aiding, assisting evaluation. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, Mr. Taylor, up until recently there was some discomfort. I mean, frankly, many jails are ill-equipped to, as you heard, provide treatment for many of our patients, even in the state that they leave the hospital when they are able to aid and assist. The most serious problem was with that of Marion County, but over the last 6 months we've reached an agreement with them that they will take patients back at the completion of their evaluation, but prior to the time when they receive the report.
And what did you do in those circumstances? Keep the patient?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Hmm. Is there a follow-up?
Please, Senator Byer, and I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry.
Thank you. On the fiscal, I assume the fiscal was prepared by your office or anyway, whoever prepared the fiscal. And we may have to get someone from fiscal up here if he wants this information. But this is only speaking to the costs to the Department of Human Services. If these people are going back to a local jail, there's obviously the person is incarcerated someplace. So to say it's going to cost $3.7 million, you know, is not accurate because we don't know what the cost of local incarceration is of the people being held. The same person is still in custody someplace. And also, you know, it says it's going to cost extra federal funds. Well, if they're in a state hospital, they must be receiving federal funds. If they're in a county jail, they're not going to be receiving federal funds.
Correct.
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, just for the record, it was not my office who prepared this, but I do believe that these numbers were referenced to an attempt to see if there, if these additional number of 8 to 12 patients were added on an ongoing basis to our census, that we could, in fact, reduce it by providing community resources. Those community resources in the form of residential facilities would allow federal funds to be utilized by virtue of the fact that they were in a residential facility as opposed to a state hospital. You are correct, I believe, in assuming that this is really a cost-shifting issue. The reality is that approximately 50% of our patients who are currently coming in on aid and assist are doing so for misdemeanors. These are people who in almost any venue that you would consider would have, other than what is currently going on in Oregon, would be civilly committed. Many counties are now using the 370 process in lieu of civil commitment so that by the time that someone is able to aid and assist, they still have very significant mental health treatment issues which are very expensive to manage in the jail or in the state hospital.
Mr. Fickle, again, let's assume tomorrow that all the sheriffs in the state decided they were not going to take these patients because they didn't see anything in the statute that said they had to. What would be the fiscal impact?
Chair Burdick, Mr. Miller, Mr. Taylor, the fiscal impact at that point would be to increase the census beyond the fiscal capacity of the hospital. As you heard earlier, we are very substantially over our budget capacity and are rapidly, again, reaching our physical capacity in the facilities that we have. The likelihood that all of the kind of things that happen when you have an overcrowded facility begin to worsen with the increased frequency of injuries to both patients and staff, to increased use of seclusion and other less than optimal treatment modalities. In terms of measuring the actual impact, that would be a function of how much overtime is promoted by the amount of overcrowding that you might engender by doing that.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, I think I'd also point out that anyone who's in Oregon State Hospital, they can't get in forensics. They can't get Medicaid match for those folks. And so folks are going to, whatever the day rate in jail and in the state hospital, that'll all be general fund or county fund for the jail. So in terms of moving between state and county budget, there will be a difference, but there's not going to be a federal match on those dollars. Also, one other difference is that some jails do release inmates when they reach a certain capacity. I don't believe the state hospitals ever released people who've been committed to their care on a budgetary basis, and so they will just move to overcrowding.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know what your intention with the bill is, but it seems to me there's an issue here. I wonder if current law is being followed, mm-hmm. And then you've got the fiscal issue besides. And I guess a question that has been asked is, it doesn't say where the state hospital or the director or the superintendent of the state mental hospital has to keep the people. I mean, the way I read the statute, it says they're in the custody of them, but it doesn't say where they have to keep them. I mean, I wonder if there'd be an opportunity for to comply with with current law if the state hospital was to return them to a county jail, but continue to treat them there, so they'd still be in the custody of the state hospital, but just not in the state hospital. That way the person would be continued to be getting the medication, and so they'd be able to, you know, if they've been medicated back, the ability to be able to stand trial. But when they leave the state hospital, they don't take their meds or whatever, and then they go backwards again. If somehow, I don't even know if it'd take a statutory change, but somehow the state hospital would keep custody of them and make sure they maintain medication so they're able to stand trial, but they could go to a different facility someplace mm-hmm. in the county.
Maybe Wapato would be good.
And most of them probably come from Multnomah County.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is quite a thorny little issue. I think we just need to continue the dialogue on this. I'm not going to do anything with this today. I was curious on the fiscal, though. You pointed out correctly, which is... it was in my brain somewhere that Medicaid funds are not available for the forensics unit of the hospital. So where is that? What is the federal funds part of that fiscal refer to then?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, anyone who's released from the hospital, whether it be persons who are found guilty except for insanity and who are under the PSRB on the civil side, or people who are released from jail and who are housed in a residential facility do have access to Medicaid funds in several different ways. They are eligible for SSI in many cases, or SSD, as well as the Oregon Health Plan, which all relates to some, in terms of the housing fund as well, that would give them access to some federal funds.
So why is it in this fiscal?
Chair Burdick, the presumption was by the persons who prepared this was that we would be forced to add an additional 8 to 12 beds of residential facilities to accommodate the additional impact on our census by this bill.
And that's the kind of arrangement you were referring to, Senator Beyer, and which you would have federal funds available for. Okay. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 528, and we're going to open. Work session. Speaking very slowly on Senate Bill 257. Change counsel here. Yes. Good question. Okay, we're in work session on Senate Bill 257.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 257, the bill provides that variable annuities are securities under the Oregon Securities Law. There are -1 amendments to this bill. The -1 amendments clarify that the bill applies only to variable annuity contracts and not other variable insurance contracts. The bill also amends a provision in the insurance code to clarify that variable annuities are subject to the securities laws. And this bill was heard originally before this committee on February 5th.
Okay. Corey Streisinger, why don't you just come on up and be a resource up here, please? Maybe you can just refresh our memory as to why we are doing this. And this is a work session, but just kind of recap for us. It's been a while since our public hearing on this.
For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill concerns variable annuities, which have characteristics both of insurance and of securities. They are sometimes, as I said in my initial testimony on the bill, referred to as securities in an insurance wrapper, and they're often purchased for investment purposes. Both insurance and securities are regulated by my department. Under current law, variable annuities are treated as insurance products for purposes of state regulation, but not securities. And there are some differences in the enforcement tools in particular that apply to those two different areas. This bill would continue the treatment of variable annuities as insurance products, but would also expand the securities laws to make them qualify as securities for regulatory purposes as well.
And I understand that you've received complaints in your office from people who were not well served, shall we say, by the financial advisors on the subject of variable annuities.
That's correct, Madam Chair. We are concerned. We do receive complaints about these products being inappropriately marketed and sold to people for whom they are not suitable or using deceptive practices. And, in fact, I believe one such complaint was referred to our office quite recently by your office.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee, either of counsel or Ms. Streisinger?
I have three pages of notes, Madam Chair, and I'm happy with this amendment.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I just, there were people from the insurance industry here earlier. They're no longer here. But they were all in opposition to this bill when it was first heard in the committee, and I was wondering if this amendment makes them happy with the bill or not.
Can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, obviously I can't speak for them, but the amendment clarifies the bill but does not, I believe, change the ultimate purpose of the bill. So my assumption is that if the insurance industry was unhappy with the bill as written, they continue to be unhappy.
And they had a chance to testify in the hearing, and I believe they did.
They did testify in opposition to the bill, yeah.
Counsel?
One concern they had, which was addressed in the amendments, was they were afraid that removing the word or variable on page 4, line 2, created an ambiguity as to whether it applied to variable insurance or not. And so that is the purpose of at least one of the amendments on the dash ones, was to ensure that it only applied to variable annuities and not variable other forms of variable insurance.
Variable insurance. So they're probably still unhappy, but not quite as unhappy.
Right. So they're a little less unhappy.
Okay. That helps, Senator Beyer.
It does help. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have other questions?
Nope, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in moving this bill. Are you interested in making a motion on the dash one amendment?
Make a motion on the dash one amendment, so I'm not interested in moving the bill.
Okay. We'll take Senator Beyer's motion on to move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 257. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 257 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 257 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections?
Yep.
Senator Beyer objects. Why don't you take the roll?
Senator Cruz, Hughes, Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Burke?
Aye. Bill 257 is on its way, and I will carry it. Okay, let's see if we can. Okay, which one is the quickest? What do you want?
I think 109 is ready to go. And then let's get on that.
Have you looked at it?
Yes.
Okay. Should we open 109? Okay, open a work session on Senate Bill 109. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 109 has been before this committee two other times. It deals with increasing the fees, the filing fees for charitable organizations and the delinquency fees. There was some concern at the last hearing that the fees that they receive only be used to administer Oregon's charitable laws, and I believe the proponents have worked with Senator Beyer on getting language that is acceptable, and those are the subject of the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay, any questions?
Well, Senator Beyer, Madam Chair, had a lot of good questions. Like, he used the words as long as possible and down the ways, and he was very concerned. We had a lot of testimony. I remember this bill. It was a little bit grueling. Does the amendment take care of some of these questions that we all had?
Senator Beyer has a smile on his face. Senator Beyer, did you want to put something on the record here?
Madam Chair, I did have those same words written down on my stuff. And, yes, the amendments require the department to adopt a fee schedule, which it does raise the amount. They can almost double the amount in the fee schedule. That's why, versus the dash, whatever the last dashes were, to dash threes, we had asked them to make sure that they don't use this money to do anything but administer this program. So if you look at the dash three amendments on page two and line two, you will we will insert the phrase "and for no other purpose." So they cannot raise the fees in excess. Well, they can raise the fees in excess, you know, up to the cap, but they can't use the money for any other purpose but to administer this program. So there wouldn't be much of an incentive for them to raise fees more than they would need to administer the program.
And that was what came out of our first attempt at a work session, Senator Walker. Okay, any other questions? Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 109.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 109. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 109 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 109 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
I'm afraid you're going to say
You've
that.
You've worked so hard on this. You deserve it. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Senator Beyer.
Yeah, you know I'm going to get beat up, don't you?
Okay.
Well, that's always a
should we try to rate
good thing
through?
To see.
This one right
we've
there.
Got a limit on how much they can write.
What about this one? Really? Are these out of counter?
We have three. There are dashboards from
well,
your office.
That they're from my office because Dan Gardner asked me to have them drafted.
Okay, I think we're going to move these. Do we have out of towners on 302 and 303?
Well.
Fast? Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 302.
I think we need some testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 302 was a bill that was first heard by this committee on January 24th. It permits a creditor to foreclose on a debt secured by the property of a decedent and execute the judgment through the sale of a property. There's dash ones to this amendment, which provide that if the money received from a foreclosure is insufficient to satisfy the debt, and if collection of the deficiency is otherwise allowed by law, the deficiency may be collected by the trustee by making a claim against the estate in a manner consistent with Oregon probate law. And so the original bill says the deficiency shall be collected, and the dash ones say may be collected.
Okay, and the reason for changing from shall to may again was?
I think it was just to provide some discretion to the trustee.
Okay.
So there were some concerns at the time, and I think there are people here who can answer any questions if the committee has any.
Okay, this was a while ago. I can't remember who had the concerns on this one.
On 302.
Do you want to answer here?
I don't have any notes.
Anybody got any concerns on this?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy if you'd move the bill and get out of the committee. You've got
two other votes besides your own to do it with. Have that found.
So you have concerns. What are your concerns? That's an honest question because I just, it was a while.
Madam Chair, I'm just not comfortable doing this, and I don't know if my concerns are validated in law or if it's just my tummy, as the Senate President would say, tells me it's not a good thing to do, so I'm just going to be opposed to the bill.
Okay. Who do we have here who knows this bill? Why don't you come on up?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Mark Comstock. I'm a lawyer practicing debtor-creditor law for the last 25 years here in Salem and throughout the state, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions that any of the members might have, including any that Senator Beyer might have.
Why don't you just describe the problem that this bill is addressing?
Well, Senator, or Chair Burdick, Senate Bill 302 seeks to amend ORS 18312, which has a bar against executing against assets of a decedent. And in a foreclosure action, part of the action is one where a writ of execution is issued after a judgment of foreclosure to have the sheriff sell the property that was been pledged as security for a debt. So the action is one that goes only against the collateral, not a personal liability against the decedent at that time or against any of the heirs of a decedent. So what this bill seeks to do is, in a situation where a defendant dies during the procedure or dies after the judgment of foreclosure has been entered but before the sale of the property, what occurs is the proceeding has to stop and the creditor has to start over again because there is not a way to complete the foreclosure and resolve the status of the collateral, and quite often it's real property. So the title to that collateral is in a never-never land, if you will, because there may not be an estate, a probate estate, that is opened in the near future. So the creditor is simply stopped. You cannot resolve with regard to the collateral, and if there's no probate, you cannot file a claim against a probate estate unless the creditor were to open one, which may not be the in the interests of the heirs of the decedent. So what this bill does is makes the absolute bar that is currently in 18312 have an exception for a judgment of foreclosure that would allow the judgment of foreclosure to go forward.
Okay, but it couldn't expand beyond the property being foreclosed. You have to talk faster. This bill
does not expand the rights that a creditor would have for a deficiency judgment beyond what is already there. The creditor could have a claim against the estate for a deficiency judgment, but that is what they have right now. Does not expand those rights.
So this just pertains to the foreclosed property that would be on a track, and the track is only disrupted by the fact that the person dies.
That's correct, Chair Burdick.
Okay. Senator Brzezinski, do you feel comfortable enough to move this amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 302.
Senator Brzezinski has moved the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 302. Any discussion? Any objection?
Michael's amendment.
What?
Not opposed to
okay.
Amendment.
Okay. So ordered. Senator Brzezinski.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 302 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brzezinski has moved Senate Bill 302 as amended by the dash ones to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
objection, one objection.
Call the roll quickly, please.
Senator Cruz, excuse. Senator Brzozowski.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Byers.
No.
Chair Burke.
Aye. It goes to the floor. Senator Walker, would you be willing to carry this?
No. I said,
yes. You're such an expert on this stuff. Okay. Unfortunately, we are out of time.
Yeah.
And so we will put Senate Bill 303. Do we have time on tomorrow's agenda? Probably not. We will reschedule Senate Bill 303.
Madam Chair, it's scheduled for a work session, but I just want to put you on notice that I need to hear from Jim Marquis's clients as to his concerns about the amendment.
Okay. We'll work on this a little bit more and reschedule it at a later time. We are adjourned.
Yeah.